Good. Thank you for sticking it out to the last. I know I'm the barrier between you and cocktail hour, the time of day when we really appreciate our healthy liver, right? So that we can talk a little bit about how we're trying to maintain healthy livers here through hepatitis prevention. Appreciate the opportunity to be on the program. In particular, John Douglas and Judy Lipschitz making an opportunity for me to give you an overview about the Institute of Medicine report. And I'd like to hit a few high points of that report over the next 10 minutes or so. The IOM, of course, is the well-established agency or entity that advises the federal government on matters of science. We ask the IOM to convene an expert panel to look at three issues. How we can improve the prevention of transmission of hepatitis B and C, the most common causes of chronic hepatitis in the United States. How could we improve data collection around surveillance? And how could we put in place better systems and programs to prevent progression of disease for those persons already chronically infected with B and with C? The IOM started off by recognizing that there's still a lot to be done around prevention. These transmissions continue to be relatively common. We are having a particular problem of transmission in healthcare settings, which I think every healthcare provider needs to be aware of. Vaccine has been widely available for several decades now, but not been fully implemented, resulting in continued transmission, particularly among adults, and particularly related to sexual transmission. As we've heard earlier, HCV continues to be common among injecting drug users, and we're now seeing HCV sexual transmission among HIV-positive gay men. The burden of chronic disease is also high. This is where most of the morbidity and mortality comes from in chronic hepatitis. 4.5 million people living with chronic hepatitis B or C. Most of those persons are unaware of their infection. The current morbidity is high. Equaling or surpassing the number of deaths from HIV and AIDS. Despite this burden, the IOM noted a large inequity in resource allocation for viral hepatitis prevention, particularly in comparison to HIV funding. And they acknowledged that these resources, this inequity, was both a cause and a consequence of a lack of appreciation of viral hepatitis as a public health problem, which leads to inadequate surveillance systems, missed opportunities for prevention at the individual level, at the clinic level, and at the societal level through increased, through a failure to adequately prioritize and allocate resources. So they focused on four areas: surveillance, improving knowledge and awareness, better use of immunization, and better delivery of services for persons with viral hepatitis. They went into great detail acknowledging the large number of limitations with surveillance, the fact that very few programs, only about 9 state or local health departments receive money from CDC for surveillance, and that results in a lot of duplicate reporting, missed reporting, poor risk ascertainment, et cetera, and they recommended that all states should receive funding for state and local surveillance activities. They also did a very nice job looking at the data showing the low level of awareness among providers about viral hepatitis, just the general epidemiology, who should be vaccinated, who should be screened, and then what to do with someone if they're found to be infected with hepatitis B or hepatitis C. Similarly, they also found those limitations of knowledge and awareness among communities, including those that have racial and ethnic health disparities. As you hopefully know, 1 in every 12 Asian Americans are chronically infected with hepatitis B, yet the IOM highlights the low level awareness of hepatitis B in this population and the association with liver cancer, which is one of the leading causes of death, cancer deaths among this racial and ethnic group. In addition, low level of awareness was highlighted from African Americans, even though they have the highest incidence of hepatitis B and the highest prevalence of hepatitis C, and their deaths from liver cancer are twice that for whites. and the IOM stress different ways that we can improve knowledge and awareness. Turning toward immunization, they made a case that an effective Hep B vaccine is possible, and the CDC goal of eliminating hepatitis B transmission in the country is a feasible one, joining a WHO expert panel from 10 years earlier who said the exact same thing. And they made a very strong case that that these missed opportunities, particularly in the adult hepatitis B vaccination programs, need to be remedied and have those through resource delivery. Hopefully, as you know, over the last 2 to 3 years, we have tried to, we meaning CDC, has tried to allocate more 317 funding for adult hepatitis B vaccination at the levels that I'm showing you here. However, our models tell us that we actually need about $80 million to fully vaccinate all the adults at risk for hepatitis B. Now, we have about 590 STD clinics that are participating in this current initiative, and hopefully that's some of you in the audience. And if it isn't, you'll have additional opportunities in the future to participate, but we have many STD clinics around the country that are taking part in this program, which is very heartening to see. Lastly, they looked at viral hepatitis services, recognizing that we have this large burden of chronic disease and we have opportunities for preventing their progression to liver cirrhosis and liver cancer. However, we're challenged by the lack of a coordinated approach at the national level. Agencies of public health and healthcare delivery are uneven in their priority setting and expertise. And that we have particular populations that need particular attention. They laid out 5 core components of viral hepatitis service delivery, which I thought was very helpful, first time that's ever happened. Community outreach and awareness, vaccination and harm reduction, screening to identify infected persons, social and peer support so we can deal with issues such as stigma, and management, helping people go through treatment, and proper medical management by staff trained to deliver that type of service. They looked at various populations and recommended various interventions. And they noted that these interventions of screening and treatment could have a large payoff in the number of life years gained, and that these costs per QALY, or quality-adjusted life years, which is the typical way of assessing benefit in economic terms, were well within the usual range for interventions, both for hepatitis C and hepatitis B screening and care. They singled out the particular clinics where integration could be very helpful. And one of those explicitly was STD clinics. Now we've heard about PIXI here, and which is great to see. And viral hepatitis service delivery needs to be a priority as we talk about PIXI in STD clinics. So in summary, the IOM report stressed that it was possible to improve viral hepatitis prevention through improved surveillance, by increasing knowledge and awareness, by increasing the commitment to the national goal of eliminating hepatitis B virus transmission, by developing evidence-based screening and care strategies and having those implemented throughout the healthcare sector, including in settings serving persons at risk for viral hepatitis. We are now going about the process of disseminating this report in various meetings, such as this one, at the congressional and executive level. We've convened an HHS interagency panel to develop a strategic plan for HHS for them to act on this report. We're developing a professional judgment at the request of Congress for CDC to implement this report. And we've recently engaged the Trust for America's Health. I think some of you heard from Jeff Levy earlier in the day. And his group will be working on an action plan to help guide Congress in identifying ways that they can implement the IOM recommendations. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ward. Can we get a round of applause for all of our speakers? You've just seen several examples of trying to, you know, maximize opportunities so that we can provide effective services to our clients from a holistic perspective. And as agreed, most of the speakers have said they will stick around to ask any answer, any questions that you might have. So are there any questions? What?
It was sort of a two-pronged question, but the first one was you mentioned that you plan on doing some looking into what how it impacts the time of the service delivery. And I think I work in New York City SD clinic, and we did look into providing, doing at least a pilot of providing contraception at one of our clinics, but the major concern is the impact on the time of the visit, particularly because right now our clinics, as you saw, have over 120,000 visits per year, and we just don't have the time to actually do it. And so there's a concern that it's going to take. So when you said 6 minutes that you thought it might add, that struck me as very low. So I'm wondering where you're getting that estimate from.
So as part of our study, we've done phase one and phase two. Phase two is after integration of the chart with that electronic medical record where everything's in one place. Before, it used to be that the family planning chart was a separate chart and you had to pull it down and then people wouldn't remember and there was it took more time. So we did that first, we did that time study in October. And what we, no, actually December. And we did it for 2 weeks and all the visits for that time period. And what we found is that to provide integrated family planning STD care, initiation of birth control, remember, using in Title 10, you use a delayed exam process. So you don't have to do a complete exam to provide birth control. And it was, on average, 6 minutes to integrate the two together, provide the services and treatment. That's, it was on average 6 minutes. That was the time. Now we're going to do it again. We're going to repeat it with the integrated chart and all of that. But yes, the difference between providing STD clinic alone versus STD family planning integrated service, because a lot of times the messaging is very similar so that you can save time. And then you can discuss. Now, there are people that have no idea, and those people will take a lot longer. So.
So it's actually like one more follow-up, but the second question was around, sorry, I forgot what it was. Yeah, sorry.
I was wondering if you have any exclusion criteria for ensuring an IUD, since you're seeing patients in an STD program, an IUD seems like an interesting choice for
So we have a whole screening criteria that we go through. So if a person comes in and sees a nurse, the question relates to IUD and screening. And so for a person who comes in and they want an IUD, the clinician who's seeing them will do a pre-screening evaluation, which will go through every possible contraindication. And then, so we go through all of that. They have to have STD testing. Pap smear, if it's applicable, like a 17-year-old doesn't have to have a pap, so we won't do it. And then we'll do STD testing if they haven't had in the past 3 months. Then they'll have a subsequent appointment with a nurse practitioner who will review the results and then consent them at that time, make sure they meet the criteria, and then we'll put in the IUD that day. And we have both Paragard and Mirena available. So the question relates to sharing staff between STD clinic and family planning. Everybody is in the STD clinic. It's an STD clinic that we put family planning into the STD program. So when I started there in 1989 as a family doctor, I thought it didn't make sense that you didn't provide contraceptive services to women who are coming in and they're having sex and they could get pregnant besides their STD. And we've done studies subsequently to show that you can integrate them together and provide it. So all staff are trained in both. And it's been a process over 15 years or 20 years to move that into that process. But it has, so everybody, it's an STD clinic that has family planning, initial family planning services, and only continuity clinic for certain high-risk people. So the question is related, do you have to have STD service to get family planning? And no, you can walk in and say, I need EC, you'll get EC, and we'll give you then STD screening. So you can come in and say, I need STD screening, and we'll give you family planning, even if you didn't know you were going to get it. So, and the guys don't know. They're just like, who? And for our Title X reporting, we're the highest. We probably do half of Colorado's male family planning visits because we see so many men in an STD program.
So do you offer hepatitis B vaccination as part of that package?
Yes, we offer vaccination for Hep A and Hep B. Yes, we have an immunization clinic too. I want HPV too.
Yeah, walk-ins or appointments
or both? So the question relates to walk-ins or appointments. We have both. You can call in and get an appointment. You can walk in and you can be seen that day. Now, you might not be seen right then because we're having appointments done. So you might have to come back at 2 o'clock. Or you could say, come back tomorrow morning and have an appointment at 8 a.m. So it just depends what's up. But nobody waits more than a day at the most.
I just was curious. It looks like you've been providing HIV and STD partner services integrated since the beginning of time, if you will. The title of your presentation, From Recommendations to Practice, did you guys actually change anything recently since the recommendations came out? Or you guys kind of were like, we get the gold star, we've been doing it. Like, I'm just curious if anything has changed or if you were already doing all of those things.
No, not too much changed. I think we added the linkage service workers to actually be able to do partner elicitation as well at a later point. So it did give us a chance to think a little bit further than where we are now and always looking to improve. So I think that's the piece that we're moving towards. No, in Texas, that's a lot. Yeah, it's a statute that they can do partner elicitation.
Mm-hmm. We're sort of struggling with this in Baltimore. Your relationship with your CBOs when they started to do partner services, how did you set that up? Did you go in and train them? And how well is it working as far as the communication of information back and forth between the CBOs and you guys? You know, they really interviewing people in 7 days, that kind of thing.
They do partner elicitation, correct, and only, correct. And yes, I think we've moved to tighter guidelines with our community-based organizations where we do a lot more monitoring. And we expect more reports on a monthly basis, and we're doing more site visits, and we've combined prevention, quality assurance, along with the physical piece as well. So we're in there doing a lot of things quite frequently, and so that has opened up communications, and we're better able to monitor them a little closer. Okay, thank you.
This question's for Dr. Trigg. I just was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the buprenorphine dispensing and whether or not that was done with STD clinic patients. I wasn't sure if I caught that or if it was specifically with incarcerated individuals, and if it was with STD clinic patients, how that was integrated and how you screened for drug use with those with that population.
Our priority groups are people coming out of the jail. We tell people with the video, which I have on my slide set. This is actually the video that we show that was made in correctional facilities in New Mexico. So that's one priority, and the other is people who do syringe exchange, and we do syringe exchange at the STD clinic. There are 49 public health offices out of 60 in New Mexico that do syringe exchange. Now, if someone comes in through the STD clinic, we always ask people about their drug use. So we, a number of people have started who came in, you know, just to get their chlamydia treated, and they walked out with a prescription. If the clinician, you know, was there who could prescribe it, and they, you know, they had the time. The alternative would have been to have someone come back in a. We do a class actually once a week. So normally we would refer someone to the class, the Suboxone class. We don't like people to think they can just walk into the health department and walk out with a prescription, because the medication actually has street value. And we're not, you know, these are hard times economically, and we're not interested in, in that happening. So on the other hand, we do what we call low threshold. You know, there are some places where you have to have 3 visits with a counselor before you can get a prescription for Suboxone. So we do it after a class and then on the second visit. So generally speaking, if someone just comes in through the STD clinic, we'll talk to them about it, refer them. But there have been situations where someone was like out of prison. A guy was 11 years in prison, was on the verge of getting, violating probation. I mean, this guy was going to spend the rest of his life in jail, and we were able to start him. So it's, yeah.
How, the cost of those prescriptions, is that covered for people who can't manage that? And how do you work with that?
Right, okay. It is covered by Medicaid. In New Mexico, but actually our program is specifically for people with no insurance. So we have we had some state funding. I maybe shouldn't say this in front of Dr. Ward, but there was some money in the hepatitis program. But seriously, this is the ultimate. I mean, hepatitis C. Yeah, I know. So we initially used that, some of that money. That money disappeared, and now the county is actually giving us money to do that. And county governments, we see, have a huge stake in this because they pay for incarceration, right? And also, I do want to say something positive about hepatitis C, about our experience. You know, I showed this slide that originally 80% plus of our IV drug users were hepatitis C positive. Well, of the people we've tested in the Suboxone program in the last 2 years, about half of them didn't know they had hepatitis C. So we tested them, and it was less than 50% were positive. And some of these have been, but compared with 80%, I think it certainly suggests that our syringe exchange program has been successful, because some of these people, I mean, I used to expect anyone with 5-10 year history of injection, I assumed they were going to have Hep C, and in fact, they're nothing there. It's 0.5, yeah. And
the guy who's saying syringe exchange is great for HIV and just pretty good.
Yeah. And I know it's sort of anecdotal, but it is shifting our, you know, our thinking about it. So, yeah. Okay, there's 2 proven treatments for opiate addiction. One is methadone and one is Suboxone. And methadone's been around 40 years. It's acquired a lot of stigma. And some of the stigma is about the way it's regulated, that you have to go to a methadone clinic every day and you line up with people who also have histories of drug addiction. So we actually, what I say to my patients is, look, this is about you. If you're healthy and happy and living the kind of life you want to lead on methadone, you should stay on methadone. You know, I mean, that's what it's about. It turns out that our Medicaid doesn't cover methadone in New Mexico, even though many states do cover it. So people financially, if they can get Medicaid, then that's the reason that people are getting off methadone. But our goal is not to get anyone off methadone. It's for people, again, to be doing well. And yeah. Okay, thanks.
I just want to say to Dr. Trigg, you know, although there is categorical funding, CDC, we realize in order for this to work, we have to maximize our resources. So we understand out there that we are asking you to do service integration and integrate programs, but there's the categorical funding, which sometimes creates a barrier. But we also know there are programs out there being creative and innovative and working with CDC to make things happen. So I don't want, you know, this categorical funding to, you know, to be a barrier to us doing what is right, you know, because it's the end result is what's actually best for the client. So we want to focus on the client and not on the bureaucracy of the categorical funding. I may get in trouble later for saying that, but sitting on the other side, you know, and running and directing programs, that's the only way they can be successful. So we're still working with our officials at CDC trying to just sort of problem solve around that issue so that we can better reflect what we're asking you to do out in the field. So are there any other questions? I thank you for your time.